This is the time set for arguments in the Robbins v. Spokio case on remand to the Supreme Court of the United States. Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed. With the court's permission, I ask to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. You'll use your opinions and counsel, please watch the clock. Brothers, the procedural violations alleged here meet Article 3's concrete requirement for two independent reasons. First, the intangible harm the Fair Credit Reporting Act protects students has a close relationship to a harm that is traditionally provided a basis for suit in American and English courts. Second, even if it does not, Congress appropriately protected by statute the moderate intangible interest for which consequential harm is especially difficult to prove or measure.
Why are we even limited to those two issues? It seems to me that traditional Article 3 standing is alleged here. Basically, what this complaint says is, I tried to get work for a couple of years, and I couldn't, and it's your fault. So why do we even need sort of all of this convoluted discussion of intangible versus nuts?
Your Honor, at the Supreme Court, the arguments have channeled on their way up through appellate review.
Well, I understand that, but we have to do that. Our standing and jurisdiction are issues that we have to review de novo when we're obliged to exercise jurisdiction as a court. We haven't. And so, regardless of how the parties have framed the issue, don't we have an obligation to just look at the complaint, look at Article 3, and determine whether or not there is standing?
That is not an argument we have pressed. The court can exercise its judgment to reach any issue in court. So, just what did the Supreme Court tell us upon remand to examine whether or not a concrete injury has occurred in this case?
That is the way the question was framed, yes, Your Honor. We have
resolved. Why don't we answer the question the way it was framed?
I would be pleased to. And we only have the two answers that I set forth up front. I'll answer that question in two independent ways.
Well, what is the concrete injury specifically? And this putting aside particularization, you have aside. What is the concrete issue, that concrete injury that was alleged in your complaint?
Concrete injury, the parties of the court have used three interchangeable words, interest, injury, and harm. I think they all fall in the same place, but we believe concrete injury are the economic and professional and reputational concerns that led Congress to enact the statute.
Well, you have to have concerns. You have to be able to say that because of this report that put out by Spokio, having applied for a job, was turned down for a job because of this injury that was caused by Spokio. Can you say that?
We have not said that. I respectfully disagree with Your Honor. That is the question that is asked by the remand. So that would be another way of simply saying that Mr. Robbins must show tangible harm. And the Supreme Court decision said one thing. It said intangible injuries, which are statutory rights, are no less concrete than tangible.
But you said that tangible ones won't do. I'm really very surprised to hear you walk away from that. Because certainly the Supreme Court's message was you still have to satisfy Article 3, even if there is statutory standing. But I don't take them to mean that tangible harms aren't good enough.
Nor do I. But I have to be candid with Your Honor and say that we did not press the argument before the Supreme Court.
Well, I understand you didn't press the argument, but the complaint says, I looked for work during this whole period. I didn't find it, and it's your fault. And plus, I had emotional distress damages, too. But why isn't that sort of the beginning and the end of the whole case?
Had we pressed the argument, it could be another case. I respect Your Honor's view that would be the.
And you don't think that we have an obligation to determine that all aspects of jurisdiction will be argued or not?
What I would would say, Your Honor, is we have offered a theory of standing which we think easily satisfies the remaining question from the Supreme Court.
Well, suppose you're wrong about that theory. Then what do we do? I'm only speaking for myself and asking questions. Not for the panel, obviously. But let's suppose we disagree with you on the statutory standing. Are we supposed to just walk away from that, even if we think there's an allegation of regular multivision standing?
I would not ask for what you should do. All I can tell the court, again, is that we have not pressed the argument, and we would like to press forward on the argument. We really do have a straightforward case for standing. Under the Supreme Court's decision, we really think this is a really easier case.
Mr. Russell, the intangible injury here is economic and reputational concerns. I have difficulty understanding how you alleged any reputational damage, because if I understand your allegations correctly or wrong, you're alleging that the Spokio people said about your man that he was weird, professional, and children had a high income. Of course, along outside of certain areas that we're in, it was not defamatory per se, correct?
Saying those things in common may not have been defamatory.
That's that. In order for there to be a reputation injury, don't we have to know what his reputation is and how these representations harm him in his economic reputation and pursuits? For instance, say that being wealthy and being married indicates that he's going to ask for a higher salary and that he cannot move from place to place and that it inhibits his employment prospects. But we don't know if Mr. Robbins is a man who is indeed married and has the ability to move around. We don't know those things. If his reputation now is that of a delivery man or a plumber who wants to stay at a low end, low wage job, and in one place, that's one thing that this was pretty good. Don't you have to allege what his reputation is in order to show these statements are damage to his reputation?
I can explain why. The inquiry under Spokio is not about the individual. It's about the type of harm being alleged. The Supreme Court made that clear at the end of its opinion. So the question before this court is, are the types of allegations that are issued here, meaning inaccurate information about your personal wealth, your age, your employment history, and your marital status, are those the types of harm that go to the heart of the statute? And we know this because the Supreme Court said once you meet that test, no additional showing of harm beyond that which Congress identified is necessary. Those kinds of questions, Judge Bea, are really another way of saying what Spokio argued the Supreme Court had lost, which is some showing of tangible harm is required. Those are all excellent examples of tangible harm. But we're dealing here today with intangible harm. And we go this further.
We want us to go back to the Lujan.
We think this falls directly from what Lujan says.
Lujan says, first, the plaintiff must have suffered an injury in fact, an invasion of a legally protected interest, which is concrete and particularized. So, what is the injury in fact that occurred here?
And the key words in that phrase are legally protected interest. The interest must be concrete. And what the Supreme Court was saying is, just like constitutional rights are concrete, Court would use two constitutional examples in its opinion.
Now, we're after rights, but I'm still struggling to find out where is the injury here.
So,
that has been alleged in your complaint.
So, if the interest is concrete, legally protected interest, and you allege that your statutory right to that interest has been violated, you have a concrete interest so long as it is not divorced from the statute. So, zip codes, while we make technical violation of a concrete statutory interest, are so far divorced from it that they're not actually, which I made your point. with all of Richard's videos in that case where someone might be harmed as a group. But Supreme Court ruled it out on a class-level basis, on a type basis, which is not our word. That is the work the Supreme Court did in the beginning of footnote 8. It said it drew no judgments as to other types of harms, and it could only work on a type basis. Because whatever rule this court comes up with for this interest is going to apply to constitutional rights as well. Free speech and free exercise were the examples the Supreme Court used to identify what is an intangible harm. What is the violation of an intangible right? Statutory rights, Lujan says, the source of the right cannot be the intangible harm in your reputation. So I would point you directly to the statute. So in the statute itself, the definition of consumer report in section 1681A(d)(1), if you'll bear with me, is any written, oral, or other communication of any information by a fair reporting agency that bears on a consumer's creditworthiness, credit standing, credit capacity, character, general reputation, personal characteristics, or mode of living. So the question before this court is, are these types of allegations, allegations after inaccuracies to your employment history, to your education level, to your economic health, to your age, to your marital status, do they, are they tethered, or are they divorced, because the Supreme Court's word has the symptoms, divorced, or are they tethered to the interest that motivated Congress to protect the interest by statute? And if you can show that, which we believe we easily can, no further showing of the reason why Congress identified as necessary. And I would point the court also to Justice Thomas' concurring opinion. I understand it was a concurring opinion that no one else joined, but what I think is really important about it is not who joined Justice Thomas, but who Justice Thomas joined. Justice Thomas is well aware of the concurring of a judge being versus joining the opinion. And his opinion, which he and Scalia agrees is four square with our theory of the opinion, he joined it. He would not have joined the opinion if he shared Scalia's view of what the court did. Justice Thomas was quite clear that once Congress has done its job, once Congress has identified a concrete, legally protected interest, that is all that is required. We also know that, Your Honor, from the FOIA cases and from the Beacon case. In the FOIA case, which is an intangible concrete interest, again, Justice Alito's opinion, the court makes that clear, it's not a tangible interest, it's a statutory right to records. Once you show you have the statutory right to those records, no other showing, and I don't mean to be a broken record, but I think this is the key language of the opinion, no other showing other than the one Congress identified is required. A person making a record request doesn't have to show that they need the record for some personal purpose. If they have the record, it would be harmed in some tangible personal way. It's a statutory right. The Supreme Court has found it to be concrete. No other showing is required. And beyond that, there really is no other basis to deny our claim in any sorts of harms, meaning it's tangible, intangible, concrete harms. It would have to be the categories of information we're talking about here. Congress was clearly motivated by concern that employment history, educational history, and categories like this go right to the heart of what was going on in 1970 when this election was passed, that credit reporting agencies were issuing reports that were harming people. But the problem was, this is what led to the amendments in 1996 that allowed for statutory damages. It was enormously difficult to prove a measure for the reasons that they identified. And common law courts and legislatures from the beginning of the Republic have the right to waive the duty to show actual harm in cases of this. But damage may be presumed to be a result of exception as statutory damages are applied to concrete facility. What is concrete? You know, they provide the remedy. Right. So, but the question is the legislature within its Article 1 power to do so? Does it violate Article 3 by requiring it to make no further showing? The answer is no, whether that's because you're right, whether that's various areas of the law.
No, I'm just waiting for the other decision. What I'm trying to sort out is they ruled in your favor the last time you were in front of us, and the Supreme Court vacated our decision. Where did we go wrong is you interpret the Supreme Court's analysis.
As I interpret their opinion, they believe this court, when they say they divided the concreteness requirement that merged particularization, which is that description here, as his credit report that was inaccurate, but didn't examine whether that violation caused a concrete, intangible harm. And the Supreme Court also said it offered no comment on whether this court could be, you know, whether it was right or wrong, or offered no comment on what might be the answer on remand. It simply wanted the court to take a fresh look to see whether the right Congress created, and Congress has a role here. The Supreme Court said Congress's judgment is instructive. To get back to your point, if it was about Mr. Robinson's personal reputation, there would be no reason why Congress's judgment would be instructive. There would be nothing for it to be instructive about. We have focused the court's attention on Mustard's plan since focus to what Congress did and whether it created a concrete, intangible right.
You may do so, counsel. That's fine. We'll hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Andrew Pincus for Appellee Spokio. I'd like to start with where my friend Mr. Cox pointed. I think it's important to separate interests from injury. As several members of the court have said, the focus is on harm and injury, not on interest. To take the first example, the First Amendment example that Mr. Consovoy used, sure that we all agree we have free speech rights and interests, but one can't assert a free speech claim unless the government action has harmed the individual by preventing him or her from engaging in that right. So there has to be harm in order to get into court. And so I think the question here, starting with the attorney to Judge O'Scanlon's question, what the Supreme Court think, and I think what the Supreme Court was saying was, first of all, merely pleading the elements of the cause of action does not automatically establish standing. We are merely establishing a statutory violation. There has to be harm. There has to be concrete harm, as the court said, and concrete harm is real. So there has to be something in the real world. And I think
that takes me back to my question, which I would appreciate your answer to. Our job is to determine whether or not there is standing. Our opinion was vacated, so we're starting over. And the question in front of us is whether the district court properly or improperly dismissed the case for lack of Article III standing. So it appears to me that our job is to look at the complaint and determine whether it states enough facts to establish standing under Article III without regard to the niceties of the principles that the lawyers are interested in having us develop for future cases over whether they can certify a class of interests that have that are not our job. So why isn't it enough that he has said, I tried to get work, I was unsuccessful, and it's your fault. Now, whether you can prove that is an entirely separate issue, but why isn't that enough for his standing?
Well, I think that is certainly a question that the court can address. It's the basis for the district court's dismissal was its conclusion that the allegations of the complaint didn't show harm or a risk of harm. So it seems to
me I think a fair reading of it is that I tried to get work, I couldn't, and it's your fault, and also I had emotional distress damages because I couldn't find work. That's pretty concrete, and it's pretty personal and particularized. So, without regard to whether it's provable, why isn't that enough?
Because I think what's missing, obviously the allegations have to allow a plausible inference for the it's your fault part of the equation.
That's really not, that's not about standing. It's about trace. Well, just
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I think it is, because obviously standing has to do with the harm has to be traceable to the defendant's act. That's another element of the standing equation. And so here, I think if you look at paragraphs 34 and 35 of the amended complaint, which are really the operative paragraphs, they say nothing about how the information on Spokio had anything to do with the ability to get employment. In fact, they are basically two separate statements. There were inaccurate facts about me. I couldn't get employment. And then there's a conclusory statement that the defendant has caused actual harm to plaintiff's employment prospects, but
right.
No specifics about how that's happened.
But that's There are other allegations in the complaint about how employers used this information widely and so on and so forth. And so if you draw all the inferences in their favor, as we're required to do, there's at least a scintilla of traceability.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think the way the Supreme Court has interpreted and again, it falls wrongly, but the need for plausibility is awfully hard to, because there's really nothing here about these employers. There's some general statements about Spokio, but when it comes to these specifics, there's nothing specific about any employer that the plaintiff either contacted or could have contacted or might have contacted. And we also have the problem that these facts on their face, because they show the plaintiff in a more favorable light, it's hard to say, standing alone without some indication that someone looked at them and there was adversity, they provide a plausible inference. But let me also end where I think my friend doesn't really want to go down this road, because the real world fact, as Your Honor alluded to, is this is about flexibility. And so as soon as that's the basis for upholding standing, the flexibility goes down the drain. So I think
that's our problem.
And obviously, you know, from Spokio's perspective, if that's the basis on which the claim is upheld, and it's impossible to
open it again. Why would you say that if he pledges some concrete facts to his employment, then he disqualifies himself as a class representative?
If standing is upheld based on the specifics about Mr. Robbins and what happens to him, as opposed to some general decision about inaccuracies generally, then each member of the class will have to establish standing based on the approach, and that will be an individualized issue that will make it very hard for them to certify class.
He's alleged a general reputational damage by publication of false information. That would be an allegation of concern of the class.
But if the basis for harm, for Judge Graber's like hypothesis is that the basis for upholding standing here would be you injured my employment prospects by this information. Is that the basis that every other class member would have to show some kind of injury to their employment prospects?
Or some other injury,
or to some other protected interest, but it would require a person-by-person decision, and that's not what the goal of a class action. That would make it possible for class action. So I think that's the sort of background. I
know you don't have that issue in front of us at the moment.
The flexibility, no. But I just think it's a reality that around the campus.
I want you to respond to Mr. Consovoy's argument about this intangible harm. Maybe he helped to sort it out, because I'm not sure I followed it. I'm still stuck in a loop on it at the moment.
I think the one is an important case, especially Justice Kennedy's concurrence, because what Justice Kennedy said is that Congress can elevate, can take a de facto injury, some injury that's real, and make it actionable. And so the question, I think, is Congress, has Congress done that? Has Congress said, we were just talking about the ordinary standing rules, the otherwise applicable rules, if we don't look at something special that Congress might have done in the Fair Credit Reporting Act. So the argument of the plaintiff says Congress did something in the Fair Credit Reporting Act to make actionable in federal court an injury that otherwise wouldn't meet the rules. And so I think to do that, you have to first.
No, I'm not sure that that it wouldn't otherwise meet the rules. Going back to the way the case has been argued in the sense that Judge Baio is discussing, which is, even in common law, one had the right to have the truth told about one in public. And, you know, you can't go around just lying about people to their shame and detriment that's, you know, actionable. So why doesn't it fall within the otherwise actionable?
Well, as we discussed in our briefs here, even more detail in our briefs in the Supreme Court of common law defamation, required proof of actual harm, except for a very small category of defamatory statements, basically infectious disease, total inability to engage in one's trade or commerce, or something like that. They were a very small category of things that were actionable, but they have proof of actual harm. Everything else required actual harm, which is what we're talking about. So I think that's the problem with that analogy. But if I could turn back to the Fair Credit Reporting Act,
thank you. My kids, I was enlarge on the common law court's thought was defamatory per se by saying any false information about the general reputation of a consumer is similar to defamation per se. It doesn't be defamation per quote.
Is that what they did here? Well, I think Congress could do that within limits of the Supreme Court said, but it's exactly what they did not do here, and I think it's important to look at the Fair Credit Reporting Act and how it was enacted. When the statute was originally enacted, the private cause of action required proof of actual harm. There were no statutory damages. So all of the regulatory provisions in the Fair Credit Reporting Act as it was originally enacted were only actionable by a consumer upon proof of actual harm because the only recovery was actual damages. So clearly, the original enactment of the FCRA didn't do just what Judge May was saying, which is to expand the universe because Congress created a private cause of action with the limits we can understand. So then the question is, when Congress added the statutory damages provision in 1996, is that evidence that Congress did something different? And we think it's not for two reasons. First of all, as the Supreme Court said in the Doe case, which we quote in our brief, and is true in the copyright area and a number of other areas where there are statutory damages are typically thought of as a device for relieving the plaintiff of the burden of proving the amount of harm, not proving actual harm. So simply the addition of statutory damages really can't provide a basis for saying Congress did what you said, Judge, by expanding the universe, because it's just as likely that they relieved the plaintiff of the burden of proving amount of damages in this area where it's sort of complicated. The second problem with relying on the statutory damages addition is Congress did not just provide statutory damages for violations of the provisions of the FCRA that relate to inaccurate statements. It is an across-the-board enactment, statutory damages for every willful violation. So the 1996 Act can't be taken as Congress looking at inaccuracy and saying, in the consumer context, any inaccuracy is something that should be actionable, so we're going to provide statutory damages for that reason. All willful violations give rise to statutory damages. So for that reason, I think the whole theory that the FCRA did something to elevate any previously non-actionable intangible injury to actual status just doesn't hold water. It's also important, I think, to say that in the Supreme Court's own opinion, Mr. Consigliere referred to the zip code example, the Supreme Court recognized every inaccuracy isn't going to be enough to satisfy Article 3. And in footnote 8, which is attached to that zip code sentence, the court said whether other false information is in the zip code category or not is something to be considered on remand. And we think what that meant is undertaking the inquiry that Judge May was basically hypothesizing at the beginning of the argument, which is, does the complaint allegations show that these inaccuracies, in the words of the Clapper case that the Supreme Court cited, in this case, create a risk of certainly impending harm? That's
what I'm saying. That's a pretty problem with the CFPB. It seems to be a pretty good argument as to why the types of inaccuracies here are not on the zip code end of the scale. What's wrong with their analysis?
I think what's wrong with their analysis is there's no basis for saying you sort of proceed on an inaccuracy basis and you make a categorical judgment that, for example,
I think that's a good court to do that. They said we can't imagine that zip codes matter.
Well, I think
that probably does matter, and so why doesn't this other stuff like your marital status, your work history, the basics about you matter?
Well, I think two answers to that. First of all, for the categories to matter, you have to find some judgment in the FCRA by Congress that they do matter. And for the reasons that I've just explained, Congress didn't in the FCRA say, we've looked at some categories and not others. It didn't do anything to elevate, to create, to expand the categories of injuries that give right to suit because of the steps in the legislation that I mentioned. And there's certainly nothing in the statute are more important than others.
This just sounds like... Well, do you really think that we are allowed to do that under what the Supreme Court told us? It seems to me that what you're saying is everything has to go in the subcourt basket.
No, I don't think it does. I think everything has to go in the basket of, just like my free speech example, is there something in the allegations here that provides a basis for a plausible inference that this inaccuracy harmed this person? In many cases...
Well, that gets back to my original question about losing a job, but...
Yes, but I think in some cases, the kinds of inaccuracy, if it's the credit report said this person was arrested and they never were, that inaccuracy by itself probably gives you a pretty plausible inference that there could be harm. Again, if you meant the second part, which is, can you show that somebody actually looked at this or would have looked at it and it would have affected you? It seems to me there are these two questions in the risk of harm category. First of all, is this inaccuracy something that gives rise to a certainly impending risk of harm? And then, are there allegations that indicate that somebody who had the power to act with respect to the plaintiff either did look at it or there's a significant risk that he or she would? Here we don't have either of those things, and I think the problem is that these categories really don't by themselves carry a signal. It's hard to say that has such a risk of inaccuracy that you can just say, yes, always, if you make a mistake and that someone's embarrassed, that has to be something that's false. I think that's much harder to do, and a little higher compensation
would make him ineligible for a forward-paying job, correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The level of compensation, the level of wealth, would make it look like he would not accept a forward-paying job.
It could, depending on the facts about him, which we don't know. It may be. I mean, that's why I go back to it seems to me, as I say, some things
should be advised. What about being too mean to supply us with facts about him?
I think that would be the appropriate course here. It seems to me that it's quite reasonable to say there are facts here that provide a plausible inference that there was a risk of the proper level of risk of concrete harm. But given that the Supreme Court decided this case and this court is going to say what the standard is, it would be quite reasonable to say that the plaintiff gets a chance to amend to meet whatever that legal standard is.
You still do that at this stage?
Yes, Your Honor. I think you can. The case was dismissed. It was here on an appeal from a motion to dismiss. They gave it a command, and so this court could say, changing the law, Spokio has decided we've now interpreted what Spokio requires in terms of allegations, and we're going to remand to give the plaintiff another chance to meet that standard. Let me go back to this question of, is there something in the FCRA or in the Supreme Court's opinion that sort of indicates that there's some basis for looking not at what these inaccuracies meant for this plaintiff, but sort of in categorical. I think Justice Thomas's opinion was a separate opinion. He did join the majority. He wasn't a critical vote for the majority. So I think it's awfully hard and would be quite unusual to interpret a majority opinion by reference to what's in a single justice's concurring opinion. With respect to
a nice try.
Yes, Your Honor. And it was especially nice try because I know that Mr. Consoy works for Justice Thomas. With respect to FOIA, the injury there, as we talked about in our briefs, and as the Chief Justice wrote in a law review article that we cited in our briefs in this court, the injury is the denial of the request for information. That's what makes it create that particularized concrete injury for that particular person that gives them the ability to sue under FOIA.
The right to protect it at all. And I would point this court to the previous information in
this statute, which Spokio has never been able to address, the preemption provision of this statute, at 1681H, says no consumer may bring an actual proceeding in the nature of defamation, invasion of privacy, or negligence with respect to reporting of information against any consumer reporting agency. How does Loss.8 happen to be no connection between common law rights of reputation and defamation per se in Fair Credit Reporting Act? If the Fair Credit Reporting Act preempts common law claims of defamation and reputation harms, there seems to be at least well more than is necessary to satisfy the Supreme Court has said about the relationship between common law and statutory rights, keeping the false subject as a content, which is the Supreme Court's decision in Stevens. There's no argument that a modern day repeater on the false subject looks exactly like a former in 1789 or the Sprint case. There is no way that a payphone aggregator perfectly replicates a common law society of a contract claim. Like the Chief Justice dissented, saying that there was no confusion. What the Supreme Court said is legislatures have rights in Article 1 to expand upon the common law and to adapt to the modern era, and it does not forfeit the connection to the common law by doing so. The parties agree that at common law, you have the right to presume damages with no showing of tangible harm for a certain allegation as to your trade or profession. Congress could be judgment. In the modern era, inaccuracies such as this in your credit report are exactly the kind of injury to your profession or trade that need statutory protection. And I would turn to this gentleman to practice law. And I think my good friend gave the keys away when he said, look at free speech, because please look at free speech. In a free speech case, here's what a court would never ask. Show me economic harm. Show me physical injury. Show me psychological harm. Those things would be for a remedies question. For injury, it is the invasion of the legally protected interest in free speech.
Justice, do you agree with the parties to anything in the majority opinion that would support that analysis?
Yes, I'll put you to three or four things. First, the court said at the outset that imputed statutory rights can create intangible interest. It said we have long been okay with intangible interest. See free speech and free exercise. It's the first analogy the court draws as to explain what an intangible interest looks like. It looks like free speech. Instead of picking over Blumach, which the court cites repeatedly, that there is no basis for discriminating intangible rights between the source of the rights.
Well, that's what struck me. I can't bridge the gap between this intangible rights concept and what Blumach is saying.
I do. So, for me, I know it's traffic bias, difficult word. The jargon gets in the way, I think, of a fundamental question, which is, it's the legally protected interest that gives you standing. You have the Constitution to create legally protected interests. You have common law to create legally protected interests. But so can statutes. And the question at this point is decided whether this statute creates a concrete legally protected interest or not. And what the Supreme Court said, the Supreme Court could have drawn the line at that level. We would have been pleased if they did. But they said, not quite. They said not every procedural violation of a statute is going to impair the interest. So you have to go one level below that. That's why Your Honor said subpoena versus other issues. And type, Mr. Pinkus says, isn't that where we're getting that from? The word type is in the Supreme Court opinion. It analyzes on a type by type basis.
Well, what about this passage? On the other hand, Robbins cannot satisfy the demands of Article 3 by alleging fair procedural violation. The violation of one of the acts of procedural accordance may result in no harm.
It may, but it also may not. The question is it a fair procedural violation, or the words of Blumach, or that's part of the Blumach, or is it a procedural violation that impairs a separate concrete interest? So does this procedural violation impair the interest and reputation and creditworthiness that are behind the Fair Credit Reporting Act? If the court thinks they don't, if they think or takes inaccurate information about your employment history, your marital status, your age, and your economic health, is
that a problem? So that, of course, is a fair amount of statements made
inaccurately in this report. Yeah. Yes, sir. So, I don't mean to fight you, but we like to think you're focusing on the wrong question. It's not whether these particular statements, it's whether the inaccurate information about this is true. It shows the interest that's protected by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. case. And we know that from the zip code example. We can all point to the case where the zip code would harm a particular individual, and if they came to court, I think they have a probable disagreement because the Supreme Court said zip codes are a fair violation. Whenever the court goes online, it's going to be a little bit over inclusive and under inclusive. I think that's the nature of trouble on a case basis. That's the bottom line.
So, this is specific for him to allege any particular injury to himself, concrete injury. Is that exactly what he would tell us? Is that a particular case?
Fulham says, as long as it's a legally protected interest, what Spokio does is elaborate. It says, if it tells the court, the question was, how do we know what a statutory violation invades a legally protected interest? They said, look at the type of harm and see what the statute is trying to address. And so there's a good connection between the violation alleged and the statute's interest.
That's the idea of zip codes.
That's what the court should
do. If we were to follow the suggestion made by your opposing counsel, then perhaps we ought to remand to allow the district court to give leave to amend. Would you be able to amend your complaint with respect to this individual as to a direct connection between his applying for a job and being told, no, we read Spokio, you can't have a job?
We'd have to look at your honor. I couldn't answer the question completely today, but we would respectfully ask the court to not require that. We really don't think it's necessary. It would be invading the province of Congress to say, when the Supreme Court said, no additional harm beyond the one Congress identified as required, for the court to say, some additional harm beyond the one Congress identified is required.
Thank you. Your time has expired. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and the court will adjourn.